that's created this work group. And I want to thank him so much because he also authored the legislation that put into statute the five strands of reading. So he's very, very interested in this topic, and I thank him for his leadership. And also Senator Olsen, who represents the North Branch area and Pine City, the home of SCRED, which is Rush City, which is the home of the St. Croix River Education District.
Our favorite place
because they really support these concepts. And also it is the home of the RTI Center, which is training our school district administrators and teachers across the state in this important concept. So, again, thank you all for being here.
And RTI means response to intervention. So let's begin our overview of parent advocacy groups. And why don't all three of you come, Cindy McCarthy, Susan Thompson, and Beth Erickson, come to the table, and we'll let you take it from there. If you'll introduce yourselves for the record, we'll appreciate that.
My name is Cindy McCarthy. I am one of the co-founders of the Parent Advocates for Students with Dyslexia, and I'm also the mother of Ryan McCarthy, an eighth grader in Wayzata School District.
I'm Susan Thompson, and along with Cindy and Benton, some other parents that are here, got together the advocacy group, and I have my youngest student is at Wayzata Middle School.
Would you, Susan, pull your mic a little closer to you?
Is that better?
That's fine. That'll be fine.
Good morning. Happy to be here. My name is Bette Erickson, and I am a parent of two children, and both of whom are here this morning to learn about how democracy works. And you'll hear more of my story as the morning goes on as well.
And I want to just mention, I actually live in Wayzata, and I open enroll in Orono School. So my son's actually at Orono.
I was going to start first. What I want to talk to you today is three things. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what Ryan and my story is and our quest for effective reading instruction, who the PADS group is, and what we're focusing on going forward in the future. So, as I mentioned, Ryan is an eighth grader at Wayzata Central Middle School. He is diagnosed with dyslexia. He is on an IEP in special education. As early as kindergarten, we knew that he had problems with reading. But it wasn't until fourth grade that he got qualified by the school after many, many sessions and advocacy on our part to get the school to recognize he had a reading problem. When that happened, my first reaction is like, finally, he's going to get some help. Little did I know that once you get him qualified, you have to make sure that the child has effective reading instruction and the school can supply it. Now, in third grade, as parents, we just didn't simply let him, the school, we knew he had problems, and as parents, we got him outside help. We had a para from the school help him until she came to me in third grade and said, Cindy, I can't teach him. I don't know how to help him. I'm doing everything I can. All the training the school has given me, I can't help him. What a wake-up call. And so then I went on a quest to look for someone that could help my son. And luckily, I found a very talented tutor that is extremely well-trained in direct instruction in the five strands. Well, so he got that instruction, and he started making progress. With just 2 hours a week after school, he was making progress. So when the school said, okay, fine, he's qualified for reading instruction, and here's the type of curriculum we want to work with him, I was educated enough to say, no, that isn't going to work for him. And we went back and forth. And so we couldn't come to a conclusion. So by fifth grade, my husband and I made the decision to pull Ryan out of school 5 days a week, 1 hour a day, to work with his reading tutor. During that time, he was able to make a year and a half worth of progress. He still struggles with fluency today, but he reads at grade level very slowly. During that time, I was talking to the school and saying, look, he's making progress. You need to give him this type of instruction. This is what is effective for him. So by sixth grade, they actually found a special education teacher that was trained in those techniques. And so by sixth grade, when he went in, we put him back into school full time, and then he had special education instruction pullout for reading. He's in eighth grade today, and he continues to make progress in his reading. He still needs direct instruction. For him, it still needs to be intensive. As a parent, I wish it could be more intensive, but he's at the point of his school career where we can't afford to give him 2 to 3 hours a day to really get his fluency up. So he's on a path of success today. He still works really hard, but he's on a path of success. During those 5 years, I felt extremely isolated. The school was helping with what they could, but they can't help with what they don't know. And there's a whole huge emotional level that you go through as a parent when you see your child struggling in class. And by third grade, he was not only struggling, he was starting to act out. I was getting notes back from the teacher saying he was becoming a behavior problem. He didn't want to do homework. He was fighting at home. I was losing my child. When we finally got the instruction in fifth grade, with the tutor, though, in third grade, when we found her, he could see that there was hope. And then by fifth grade, when he could see that he could make progress in reading, I got my son back. He could come, he'd come and hug us for no simple fact other than he was happy, and he wanted to tell us that he loved us. I didn't have that in third grade. I had a child that was angry and fighting and didn't want to do anything. So there's a huge emotional toll on the child and on the parents. Well, I knew there had to be other parents in that situation like me, and I wanted to find them because I figured together we could support each other, we could learn from each other, and we could cry on each other's shoulder if we needed to. And I can't remember, but at that time I met these two wonderful women, as well as a couple other women, and we formed a parent group. That was about 3 years ago. So there was about five of us that we just met at a restaurant, and we talked and we cried. Today, we have about 120 members, and we're adding about five members a month. As the word gets out, because we're a grassroots organization, we're volunteer, we do not charge anything. It's all because we have a passion for helping each other and a passion for teaching children to read learning. The group is from all facets of life. We've got parents that have chosen to homeschool their children. Parents that have no education beyond high school, that have gone out and gotten instruction on how to teach their children, pull them out of the school because they're struggling so much, and are teaching their children how to learn to read. We have parents that have are teachers, public and private school teachers, that have their own children are struggling to read, and they're trying to find ways to help their child, and also how to advocate better with their own school district. We have parents that are investment bankers, lawyers, marketers, parents that are small business owners, parents that are managers in large corporations. We have parents from every single walk of life that are in our group. It's kind of the blend of what Middle America is. So that's what we are today. What we work on is a network of information, education, and support for our parents. One example is the 8th grade MCA tests are being rolled out this year for the first time. And a couple of us went out to the website and downloaded the demo test and went through it as if we were a student. And we took note of what are the things that our children might struggle with. And two things we noted was it requires short answers. Well, if you have a problem with reading and you're dyslexic, you typically have a problem with spelling. So you may be able to answer the questions, but you can't write them. So what we're telling our parents today is you probably need to talk to your school about asking them to provide a scribe. We also noticed that the test is very interactive, but it does reading of the problems, but when it gets to the question and answer portion, it doesn't provide any oral support. So again, we're telling our parents, you probably want to talk to the school to have a reader available because it is not fully audio supported. Longer term, we want to try to work with the Department of Education to see if we can make changes with that. But for this year, that's the type of advice we're giving our parents. so that the children taking those tests are not at a disadvantage. We meet about every 6 weeks, and we talk about topics that our group is interested in, ways that things, effective things that have worked with their child, effective methods that have worked with advocating with the school district. We also are starting to become active in lobbying in the legislature, which is why we're here today. We believe that we can make changes on an individual level with our children, but in order to make effective changes, we became moms on a mission to change the system. We know that we can help our individual children, but we want to be able to change Minnesota, maybe the United States. We've got high ambitions. So there's three messages I'd like to leave with you today. The first one is waiting for children to diagnose them, waiting for them to fail is a flawed model. We have to figure out how to get direct instruction of the five strands of reading in the regular classroom, because there are a huge amount of borderline children that don't have to go into special ed if we can get teachers in the regular classroom that know how to effectively teach and assess the skills of the five strands. The second message is I'd like to dispel the myth that these skills cannot be taught in our university, in our college classrooms, to pre-service students that want to go for their teaching licensure. If we have parents that don't have any education beyond high school taking classes because they want to be able to support their children to teach them to read, then I submit that these very talented, highly motivated students will be able to learn those skills if the universities and the colleges choose to teach them. And third is that parents need to be educated on the five strands. In many cases, simply reading to your child, though while very helpful, is not enough. Parents need to understand what those five strands are, recognize if their child is struggling, what skill of those five strands they're struggling in, so that they can support them not only at home, but be able to advocate with the school to get them the instruction they need on those skills. So I'd like to thank you today. Those are my concluding remarks, and I hope you take those messages going forward as you consider future legislation. Now I'd like to turn it over to Susan Thompson.
Thank you. I have three children, and I want to tell you a little bit about my journey with my children, and then I want to give you optimism. I mean, we have a big, big challenge in front of us. Reading is not on the front page with good news in Minnesota, but we can put it on the front page with really good news. And I feel like I've lived a journey that informs me to come at this problem with strong optimism, because this is a problem. We're lucky. This is a problem we can solve. My journey is my first child, he learned to read without any problem. I didn't know you had to teach him how to read. He's at an Ivy League school. Life is good for him. I had two other children, equally as smart as my oldest son, had tremendous challenge learning to read. And I had no training in this. I was trained in finance. I mean, I was off in my world being an investment banker and enjoying it. And my second child was in kindergarten. She could not learn the alphabet. And when they started turning to the exercise of learning to read, she hit an absolute brick wall. And the pain in her experience, even today, could bring tears to me. It was exquisitely painful. And here's an incredibly intelligent child. And everyone is saying to me, she is so smart. She's going to figure it out developmentally. She, you know, she's a late bloomer. Don't worry about it. And so I didn't. I kept working. And I thought, she's going to be successful. I believe in her. And do you know what? She didn't progress. And so I quit my job with enthusiasm. And I thought, you know what? This is an opportunity. I am going to learn everything I can about reading. And I read. This is why I have friends.
Yes, right.
And it really is why the advocacy group is important. Because you know why? Because she just took her ACT score. She scored in the 99th percentile. So she's got a great story to tell. But I'm telling you, she started in the bottom of the basement. And so, you know what? I thought, everybody has career change. Why not take a career change? And I went back. I did a ton of research. I enjoyed reading about it. I jumped into the networks. I met great tutors. I met great professionals. And a plan developed. I mean, I was blind when I went into the process, but a plan developed. And I thought, she's going to learn to read. You know what? She is. And I went back and got training, like some of these other parents, without any background, in Orton-Gillingham, which is, you know, there are a lot of really good programs out there. Orton-Gillingham is a program, in my simple view of the world, what it does is it takes what appears to be an opaque English language and it makes it transparent. It shows a very simple system to reveal the structure of the English language. And so you can teach any child with direct instruction in a very systematic way, step by step, and they learn to read. And there are other very strong research-based programs out there, like Linda Mood Bell. I mean, there's a long list. Anyway, with my daughter, the sad story is that she didn't get in early intervention. But the good news is she had strong advocates. We got informed. We put a plan together. She had slow, steady progress. And it took 10 years of remediation for her, and most of it was private tutors. We were lucky we could afford to do that. She had a lot of strong support from well-intentioned teachers, and she closed the gap. Well, you know, the best thing in that experience, though, was filled with tremendous pain, and I'm telling you, tremendous pain to watch her struggle, is that when my third child showed up on the scene, and he was heading into kindergarten, all of the early warning signals that are easy to see were there, and I thought, we've got the same challenge. But the good news was I was informed, and I was in the network. I knew where the resources were. So I packed up my family, and we moved west like a good frontier would, and we landed in a really good district in the Orono School District where the current superintendent, Karen Orcott, used to be the special ed director, used to be a speech-language pathologist, and she gets the research, and they have a strong program. And so right there in kindergarten, all of what your legislation is about. Early intervention happened, and when my son came home, I mean, he got good instruction at school. When he came home, I worked an hour a day through the school year, and then in the summer, we had our own little school 2 hours a day, and it was all, you know, it was Orton-Gillingham, and there's a lot of other friendly programs to make the structure of the English language transparent. It can happen, direct instruction, systematically. And do you know what? The gap closed in 3 years. And he's here, and he'll tell you that story. And the only reason I go on about the journey is I'm lucky. I got to see the experience of when you don't do early intervention up front and when you do early intervention up front. And it's wonderful. And I guess that's really what I want to bring to you is, you know, then we launch into the parent advocacy group, and I meet a lot of other animated people, educated people, really. We're here because we think the problem can get solved. And you're kind enough to host us. We come here last year. We offer testimony. We get involved in the system. And only because you invited us, only because you invited us to come to the legislature. And we got involved. Then another invitation came out of that involvement. The Board of Teaching invited me to sit on the task force that's currently looking at the reading standards for teachers. And I feel, as the only parent advocate on that task force, I thank you and I feel privileged to be there because my perspective is a very different perspective on the task force. I'm learning from the professors that are on the task force. I'm better understanding the paradigm they have. And I hope that I'm communicating in a way that they can understand our needs. And we're working very hard and it's difficult. But I'm hopeful for that. And this is my final message, really. Is from my journey, when you look at this problem, I mean, let's face it, we get the NAEP National Report Card on Minnesota. 37% of our kids in fourth grade read a proficiency. Only 37% of our kids in eighth grade read a proficiency. This is 2007. 13% of our black students read a proficiency. I mean, we are all very concerned. But I look at those numbers, and having gone through my journey, I look at them and I think, I see the potential, and that's what I really want all of us to do when we see the challenge. Look at the potential, because in 2000, the National Reading Panel published this incredible piece of research. This is the recipe on how you teach reading. And I think if you ask anybody who's in the profession of reading, is this a sentinel document? And they'll say, yeah. And you've had many people talk to you about the five strands. The other reason for optimism is right here in Minnesota, good things are happening. I mean, there are a lot of people that will speak today to the professional development they're involved in, a lot of parents that have gone back and got trained. Yesterday I was at the Governor's Council on Reading First, and Dr. Barbara Taylor presented her report on the 24 schools, 4,500 students that are benefiting from this intervention. This intervention is teaching the five strands. So this is what they teach, and then she's got a big emphasis on effective instructional strategies. This is good news. I mean, she should really speak to all the data because it was 3 hours of just all of this data. But, you know, my gestalt, the visual from all the data, is it's good news. The bottom third is in these really struggling schools, the bottom third is moving up because they're teaching the right stuff and they're teaching it in the right way. And the middle third is moving up. So you're getting it's addressing not just the struggling bottom third, but the other segments of the classroom. It's progress. It's happening here because of you and because of Reading First and because of Dr. Barbara Taylor. There are other models that really inspire you to be optimistic about this hard task. In Montgomery, Alabama, okay, that school district, look at the list, 118 out of 130 for their students trying to pass the state test. Not a good situation. But they stood up, they were optimistic, they went out, they brought in a new program, Read Well, and it came along with consultants. They went in and worked with the teachers. 2002, 37% of their kids passed their state test. 2003, 68% of the kids, kindergarten through third grade, passed the test. 2004, 80%. I mean, those numbers are cause to cheer. We can do it. Linda Mood Bell, they scaled. I mean, in our area, they teach more in a intervention model where you go in as an individual. But it's a national program. They've scaled up big time in Pueblo, Colorado. The numbers are amazing. 900 teachers, and the outcome is measurable, and it's positive. They've done it in Vista, California. So, you know, I said that. See, I get animated about this, and I'm sorry I go on. But it's exciting. And really, the real message I want is, I know we have a hard problem. We're here to help, and we can help in a small way. And the other thing is the research. We're lucky. You know, my daughter was born before the National Reading Panel. For all the kids that are out there now, we know how to teach reading, right? We need to make it direct. It has to be direct instruction. It has to be systematic. And it has to take the opaque English language and make it transparent. We can do it, and every child can read. Thank you. I know I get going.
That was great. No. Glad to be on this team with you, too. My name is Bette Erickson, and I want to start with the message that every child has the right to learn to read, and it is the responsibility of the adults to see that it happens. Every child has the right to learn to read, and it's the responsibility of the adults to see that it happens. My first child is bright, engaged, excited to go to school, and puts a string of pearls around her neck as she heads out to kindergarten. And then they threw this thing out to her called the alphabet and learning to read. And she's remained engaged and excited and enthusiastic about kindergarten, but was not getting the code of language. Could not learn the alphabet letters. And I am a graduate of elementary education. I have an elementary education degree from 25 years ago. And she would come home in the afternoons, and I would sit with her one-on-one and give her pennies to learn letters of the alphabet. But what I was doing was more of the same. I was not taught in my undergraduate program how to teach reading. And I would go to her teachers and say, what do you do? And they'd give me ideas or send activities home, and I'd do more of the same with her. She was pulled out into a small group that at the time was supported by, I think, Title I money, and they did more of the same, only in a small group setting. And in second grade, we hired a tutor to come into our home twice a week, a reading tutor. Twice a week, 2 hours a week, one-on-one instruction. Formed a great bond with my daughter. Terrific woman, very smart, but she also had not been trained in how to teach reading. And so they had a great relationship, but she did not learn how to read. In, you know, as things happen and we thank whoever's in charge for the opportunities that cross our paths, but I was given the name of Arlene Sunday, and you'll hear her name later. She developed the Sunday system learning to read, and someone told me, if you can just talk to her or find her. So I went to a phone book, and I looked her up, and I gave her a call, and she invited us to participate in a program in St. Paul where they were training teachers to teach students how to read. And we drove over one night a week, and they needed students for the teachers to practice with, the practicum. And now understand, again, I had worked with my daughter on my lap for hours and hours. We had a very rich environment at home, language-rich environment. I was a trained teacher. We had hired a one-to-one tutor for a year. She had worked in small groups in school, had not learned to read. In third grade, she knew the word one, O-N-E, and you know that's a sight word because it follows none of the rules. She knew the word one, and she started instruction in St. Paul one night a week for 50 minutes, and they taught her the code of the English language in a systematic and explicit way. They did not assume she knew anything. They did not assume she was going to, by osmosis, learn these skills. They explicitly, clearly, and precisely taught her that the A-Y at the end of a word says A. And we were driving home. She was a third grader. She had had basically was a non-reader. And we took the Penn Avenue exit off of Interstate 394, and she read the sign one way. And I will obviously never forget it. And I appreciate the opportunity to share that story with you all today. And the message is that it is not more of the same that works. It's something different that works. And I absolutely applaud the comments by my colleagues up here. We know what that is. And it is our responsibility as the adults in this community to give all children the opportunity to learn to read because it is their right. I went on to obviously join other parents. Once you make sure, first of all, you make sure that your child's going to be okay. And once you know that's going to happen, and you know, you have your doubts, of course, but once you know that's going to happen, the message quickly becomes much larger than your own child. And you realize that we are the fortunate ones sitting at this table who had the resources to privately provide for our child what they needed. And the message becomes about all the other kids out there who don't have the opportunities or the parents who just simply do not know what it is that their kids need. And the cost to our society on a personal level and a larger economic level is huge. And it's just simply unacceptable that we have numbers of 37% of our students reading at proficient levels. And so this is our mission. And I'm here to share that there is effective instruction out there. We know how to do this. We can do this. I've gone into, after receiving more advanced training, I've gone into an elementary, public elementary school in Minneapolis where my children were students. And we started through private donations and small grants and foundations a training program to train volunteers to work with kindergarten through second grade students who were falling behind. And again, it is not hard to figure out who these kids are. You can see it in kindergarten through district-wide screening. You use the data. You look at the students. You don't look at the families they come from. You don't look at the language spoken at home. You don't look at the color of their skin. You don't look at whether or not they're a bright student and they can engage. You look at the data. And you decide who is not at benchmark. And those students need early intervention. And we've trained volunteers The curriculum we brought in, because it is so user-friendly and accessible, is called the Sunday System, again developed by Arlene Sunday, the Sunday System Learning to Read curriculum. And we had in place in that elementary school, still do have in place, a third grade program. We have one individual who's primarily in charge of making sure that all kids can read by third grade. And obviously, if any one person could do it, she could do it, but she can't do it. And we partnered, and she said, is there anything we can do with the kindergarten through second graders so that I don't get third graders who cannot read? And the good news in our program is that we have a community of great volunteers at this school, and we have the fortunate benefit of some foundation support, and we've been able to bring in curriculum and train parents and identify students. And she said to me last year, "Bat, I'm getting third graders, and they know their short vowels." And she's just thrilled by the fact that they're not starting at ground zero, that these kids have had the benefit of some early intervention, and she can start there and bring them forward. And for the most part, avoid any further remediation with most of these kids. They get the effective instruction with her in third grade, and most of the children are then successful in the mainstream classroom and doing fine, and that's the end of their story about reading. So I thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today, and of course we all reflect on our journeys and what it means to be here. And I just want to leave you with the message that every child has the right to learn to read, and it is our responsibility to see that it happens. Thank you.
Well, thank you, the three of you, Cindy, Susan, Bette. If we didn't hear another word, I think we've gotten enough motivation here to propel us and compel us to the action that we need to bring about and help you carry out your mission. Bless your hearts.
Thank you,
Senator Olson. If I may just add, you inspire us. And the resources and the advocacy and the knowledge that you have shared with us are pushing us forward. And I know that, you know, Senator Olson and Weger, we have not been as involved with us in our contacts with you. But we've been out with education committees across the state, and every time we come upon a school that wants to do this or is looking at resources to do it, we all look at each other, see, yeah. This is what we have to do. And it's just powerful testimony. So thank you so very much for being here.
Thank you.
I have a comment, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
This was Cindy's 3 points there. And it's been fun watching these two because, you know, there's an obvious desire to improve education in Minnesota. But your first 2 points, those things came up, you know, waiting for students to fail with RTI, you know, by going after those kids at an early age, you know, not waiting for third grade to find out that, you know, they're not going to pass their MCAs. So these two are very, and I think our whole committee is very much in favor of pursuing that. But also we stumbled along. There were some new younger teachers there that day, and I think Senator Olson asked a question, you know, what have you learned about this in college? Nothing. And so your point there, you know, we've been hearing that, and I think there will be some action taken. So, but I appreciate you reinforcing there what we've kind of been finding out, too. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is representatives of the Rochester Reading Center. Welcome to the table. Nancy Sears and Jan Hagedorn. If you'll just introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Hi, I'm Nancy Sears from the Reading Center in Rochester. And I'll tell you my story first. And it begins as a mother. My son has dyslexia. My husband has dyslexia. My son's dyslexia was not identified until he was in sixth grade. We didn't realize that the falling all over the floor and acting out in school was a result of his not being able to learn to read as well as his peers. He was feeling stupid and dumb because from IQ testing that we had done at the Mayo Clinic, he was very intelligent, but yet he, for some unexpected reason, could not learn how to read. And it's much easier for a child, as I see working with other students, that acting out is preferable than having other students think that you're dumb. And the problem is you yourself feel like you're dumb, and that does not go away even into adulthood. I still see it in my husband. So at sixth grade, I found actually a reading center teacher. I wasn't involved in the reading center at that time, but that teacher taught him about syllables. He was sixth grade. Syllables, you can take a larger word and break it into small pieces. So that teacher was actually teaching to his intelligence as well as teaching him the basics of the language that you would learn in first grade. And that seemed to turn the light bulb on for him. He had probably three other reading center tutors down the road, but I must say there wasn't at the time a happy ending to that story. I got to know all of the police officers in Rochester. There were some who came and sat at my table at 3 o'clock in the morning because of my son becoming involved in drugs and alcohol and the things that people with low self-esteem may turn to. I went to a high school conference for my son. My husband and I were very involved in the education portion. I went to this high school conference. The teacher had never met my son. I would drive him to school in the morning, let him off, and he'd probably go out the back door. So we went to all kinds of extremes to have him learn lessons, learn the hard lessons while he was still a juvenile, so he didn't end up in prison as an adult. And from that and wanting to save other parents from the horror that that puts on a family, running away thinking your child is dead, you know, it's just unbearable. The happy side, he's 30 now. He's still living at home. He's very, very good with computers. So he is able to work on that with my husband. But the loss of possible whatever else he could have gone into, I'm not sure will ever come back. With hope, maybe it will, because we're seeing that he's becoming more and more sure of himself as time goes on. But those early years were just, no child should have to go through that. In his first grade class, there was a pilot program that a reading center teacher was doing where she was teaching the most at-risk kids in his first grade class how to teach reading using the Orton-Gillingham approach. And Samuel Orton was a neuropsychiatrist who studied the brains of people who had died and could see through the slices of the brain that the brain is designed differently. Anna Gillingham was a teacher who worked with Dr. Orton, and they put together the Orton-Gillingham approach, which many of the other methods that you'll hear about are based on. It's mainly learning the structure of the language, because if teachers don't know the sounds, the correct sounds that the language makes, if they don't know that those sounds map to letters, it'll be very hard for them to teach children how to read. Speaking is natural. Our brains are hardwired to speak. Our brains are not hardwired to read and write. That's a man-made code that has to be explicitly taught. And in my going around to other schools, I hear kindergarten teachers who use the sounds for, they say, ka-a-ta, and expect the children to make cat out of that. And there's no way you're ever going to make cat out of ka-a-ta. So the teachers, first off, have to learn the way to pronounce the sounds correctly, and they have to know the structure of the language. From my experience as a parent, I went on and took training at the Reading Center and learned all of the what Betts was talking about and what the other people were talking about, how the language is structured so that you can teach it explicitly to children, losing my voice, excuse me, to children. And I learned that there. I also, at the time, was going to Winona State University to get my elementary ed and my special ed licensures, which I do have. In those classes, I never learned anything about how to teach reading, ever. So there's no way that I could have gone in the classroom and saved children at the early ages. As it turned out, my advisor was head of the special education department at Winona State, and he contracted with the Reading Center to come in and teach a year-long class at Winona State in the special ed department. And we actually taught those students, 30 of them per year, it's a year-long graduate credit course still going on, how to teach reading. And those teachers said that they were ready to drop out of education program because it was worthless until they took our class. And they felt like they could go out and would be able to teach children how to learn to read. And some of the schools in that area said, I only want teachers to come in and be as a teacher trainee if they've had the Orton-Gillingham class. So that is still going on. We have rumors that they're trying to cut down on the amount of hours of that. That class also has a practicum. So we bring students in, and the teachers who are learning how to teach have an actual student to work with under our supervision, which I think is vital for these teachers to learn how to read. The Reading Center also went to the effort to become an approved supplemental educational services provider by the State Department of Education, which coming up next year in Rochester, there will be failing schools, and chances are that the Reading Center will be going in. But to try to help prevent that, because I feel like teachers need to know how to teach reading when they are brand new teachers going into the classroom. What we're doing, we're partnering with the Rochester Public School District right now. We have a pilot, one of the smaller elementary schools as our pilot school, and we have 20 teachers, all the teachers from this elementary school plus, or 10 of those plus 10 reading teachers, and we are teaching them the structure of the English language. And many of those teachers said, why didn't I ever learn this before? What we're doing that's making it so effective, the Rochester Public School District has adopted as their core curriculum the Scott Forsman curriculum, which is very research-based. It has the five strands. It's wonderful. What one of our teachers is doing is infusing Orton-Gillingham into it. So she's gone through every teacher manual, every book, pulled out the spelling words, put them together with how to directly teach whatever sound goes along with those spelling words, so it's not a total guessing game. Even the students that are being taught are so excited, why didn't I learn this before? The student that I'm teaching now at the Reading Center, when we get to the sound PH, he says, hey, that's from the Greek, and he gets so excited. If we can just get that excitement into these kids and teach them what they need to know, I think it's vital. And I think it's vital that the children learn in the school, at kindergarten, first grade, because when we look at poverty, the children are not going to be able to go to after-school programs. They have to get it during their school day. And the only way they're going to get it at their school day, during their school day, is if the teachers are trained correctly so they know how to teach it to them. I firmly believe that. And I think I will stop there and turn it over to Jan.
Nice job.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jan Hagedorn. I also am on the staff at the Reading Center. I like the other people sitting at this table took this path when my oldest son was having trouble learning to read. He was a very bright boy, and by the end of first grade, he could not read a word. And when we would try to read with him, he would physically have reaction, and he would get really hot. And so we would be reading very simple books, and by the time we would get to the end, he'd be in his underwear and sweating because he was having a physiological reaction to the stress of trying to do it. But we were told it's okay because he's a boy and it's developmental. He'll grow out of it. By the middle of second grade, he would come home from school, throw his backpack across the floor, and he would crawl up under our dining room table and sit in the fetal position. And, you know, this was this bright, vibrant boy. And you know, and I was just in a frenzy, as you would imagine, because I knew there was more there. We did get him a tutor through the Reading Center. He did qualify for an IEP. He did for 5 years. Or actually, he was on an IEP through eighth grade, but we stopped using the services by the middle of sixth grade because he was actually clustered in a time frame that worked well for the schedule in the classroom, but it wasn't working with the skills that he needed. So he decided he'd rather stay in the classroom than go for the school training. But with 5 years of Wharton-Gillingham, he's been very successful. He, too, scored in the 99th percentile on his SATs in the reading. He'll be able to do whatever he wants to do now. But he wouldn't have made it without the help. Once I realized that my son was going to be okay, I felt that it was my need to help the kids in the classroom that I could see, because I was in the classroom all the time. There were other kids that also had the same issues, but they didn't have the tutors. And so I, along with our elementary principal, set up a program to do some intervention for kindergartners. I'd done the research, I'd done the studying, and I would take the most at-risk kindergartners for 15 minutes a day and work with them on basic phonetic awareness, phonemic awareness, the things that kids need to know to be a reader eventually. But we made it fun. We sang songs. We, you know, the kids loved it. They would graduate out of my area, and ESOL kids were coming in. There was no title program in our school, so this was the best that we could do. But we kept very, very, very careful notes and records of the progress of these children. And the most risk kindergartners could be indistinguishable from their peers at the end of kindergarten if we intervened with them and gave them explicitly what they needed, that 15 minutes a day. The kindergarten teacher that I worked with was so involved and so impressed with the change, because she'd been teaching for a number of years. She started incorporating the same activities into her classroom. And so the kids didn't need to be pulled out anymore. duh. And but she left to go teach at a school that had a title program. So she was teaching all day kindergarten, because in Rochester we have half day programs. And the teacher that moved in wasn't involved, and so the program essentially ceased. So I decided, well, I'm going to still do this because I know it works and it's important. And so at the Reading Center, we have continued to develop the pre-reading skills classes. But our components for this class are that we keep the parents involved, and the programs are structured in a way that it's like going to music lessons or dance lessons. We meet an hour a week, and the parents come along, and we teach them games and skills and ideas of what they can do at home to get the kids up to the level that they need to be to function, to learn to read. And because we've assessed them with standardized, normed assessment tools before they come into the class, I know what each child needs help with. And so we can structure the classes in a way that they get those components and reinforce what other kids need at the same time. It works. And the people that are involved, the parents that are working with us, are more than happy to do it. They just didn't know what to do. And the teachers in the schools haven't been able to tell them, because I honestly believe that the teachers don't know. So I guess my parting words are, I want you to know that language is the vehicle that drives the curriculum in the schools. Even when you study languages, you have to use language to do that. And because it is the only way that teaching is communicated, it's important for the teachers to have the absolute understanding of what the language is, how it's structured, so they can identify when the kids are having problems in a way that they can intervene with it before it becomes a lifelong problem. Oh, I got one more thing, too. I just wanted to say that, you know, Orton was a neurologist or a neuropsychologist, and so all of his assessments were made on people that had brain injuries. He saw what areas were lost in their function and then made assumptions about how that all worked with language and brain processing. Now that they can do brain imaging, the neuroscience field is absolutely able to document with imaging that the Orton-Gillingham methods actually changes the brain structure to make non-readers light up the centers in their brain that are, make them readers. And so science has caught up with the practical work that Orton had used. And we know so much more now that we can document with the help of science that it seems prudent to use that information to get the best education we can for these kids.
Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you, Senator Olsen.
What is your relationship with Rochester School District? Are you guys a part of it or a separate entity or in your contract with them, or how does that work?
We're a separate entity. We're a nonprofit United Way agency, the Reading Center is. We have been for quite a while. The Reading Center was formed in 1951, so we've been there over 50 years. We're basically partnering with the Rochester School District at this point, and hopefully it sounds like for the next several years, their hope is that we can go into many of their different elementary schools and do staff development. You know, it doesn't seem fair that the school district should have to pay for it when the teacher should be coming in knowing how to do it ahead of time.
And on that note, Senator Olsen, our next hearing will be on staff development and teacher preparedness. So this hearing is sort of a lead-in to that topic and that discussion. So thank you much. You know, it would be interesting to develop a list of programs that are available within our state that provides this kind of training outside of our higher education institutes. I know that we've heard of school districts going outside the state or going to Washington, D.C. or, you know, Oregon to get this kind of training. So it would be interesting to know what our own infrastructure is and if it needs to be developed. Certainly the RTI Center was one thing that we have funded as a state, but I don't think it goes as far as teaching the specific reading strategies, but it complements that model. So again, you inspire us, and it's just amazing the stories of how parents are leading this effort, and I think that's what makes us so very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we have the Minneapolis Public School model of general education interventions. Nancy, is it Kepke, Rachel Sherman, and Kathy Lawless?
Hi, I'm Nancy Kepke. I'm going to start this off. I need to get into Dinah.
Can you pull the mics just a little closer to each of you?
Okay.
Just be sure you pick up
better?
Your voices. No, that's
okay.
Thank you.
My story is about my youngest son. I live in the Minneapolis public school system. I have a son who started, my oldest son, started in 1990, And my youngest will graduate from this particular grade school in the year 2011. So I will have spent 22 years in this particular grade school. He was pulled out, my youngest was pulled out in first grade because he was showing that he could not read. Being the fact that he was my fourth and seeing that my other three children, two sons in particular, who were very slow readers, eventually did catch up. But with my fourth son, he is very emotional, very afraid. He started school expecting to know everything. He had three other older siblings, and to him appeared that when you started school, you knew everything. So he was afraid. He was very afraid. And with the sundry system that was started at this particular grade school, they did things bit by bit. He was a guinea pig of sorts because the teacher that was leading it knew of our family because, like I said, he was the fourth one. And it was... She knew that he probably would eventually catch up, but he was so afraid. He would come home in tears, fearful. Nothing quite helped. I would try to help him at home. His siblings would get involved, but he felt that he was stupid. He started very slowly. He improved by the end of the school year. By the middle of his second grade, he was up to where he was actually, his comprehension was a couple grades ahead of where he was, had been, or what grade he was in. He was actually testing at a fifth, sixth grade reading level. Ever since then, he has, on the standardized testing, he has been above average reading. The thing of it is that so often kids are expected to learn to read or learn things in the same manner, and each child learns at a different way. I have a niece who is in the Vadnais Heights area, could not read very well. Her parents took her out, went to Huntington, spent about $10,000, and she did eventually catch up. But the public school system, even up there, could not do it. I have a nephew in the Milwaukee public school system. The school that he goes to is very similar to the Edina school system. He was caught early on. He had a learning disability. He could not read. He could not comprehend what was being said. He eventually went to the university system to be tested there. They recommended actually to go outside the public school system to get additional help because they knew that he would not get the help that they felt that he was going to need to succeed. He did eventually go through a private school system for reading, and he did catch up with his reading, but the teacher that finally did say that he had passed it all said that everything she was taught how to teach to read did not work with him. She did everything backwards. That was the only way he could succeed. He is in high school. He's doing well. It's the type of thing that I see so often that there's not one way that a teacher is taught coming into a school system that really can help some of these kids. My parents came from Colombia. I'm basically a first generation, coming out of the school system. There were five of us. I was one of five. Four of us were flunked in first grade because we could not read. And it's affected me greatly because I'm afraid. I'm afraid there's times when I can pass by a particular old playground and panic sets into my stomach because of school and the stress that I felt at school. I had a difficult time. I got through school, but I did not feel comfortable. I struggled from kindergarten straight through college. I think that, you know, a child starting off in kindergarten is so affected by everything, feeling stupid, feeling like they can't do this. And like my youngest son, for some reason, some kids think that when you go to school, it should come to you easy. You know, it's like when I was little, I thought every time my birthday came by, I'd be smarter for some reason. It doesn't work that way. I just think that early on, a child, you know, it's just so much easier when they're not so afraid to learn. And sometimes what teachers are taught and sometimes how they proceed on so much affects how the students feel about themselves and how that student eventually looks upon themselves and how they proceed in life.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Kathy Lawless, and I have three children in the Minneapolis School District, a fifth grader, a third grader, and a second grader, and they cover the whole levels of reading. My fifth grader is an average reader. He learned quickly, but just got up to about average, where he's stayed. My second grader taught himself to read and has never had a problem reading, except for stopping reading. And my third grader was identified in first grade as struggling. He was pulled out of class to have individual instruction with a Sunday tutor. And then that continued into second grade, working individually or in a small group, learning the things that don't come naturally. Phonics, knowing that a letter makes a sound, knowing that those sounds can be put together into words. He still struggles with that. He's in the special reading program for third graders now that hopes to bring them up to grade level by the end of third grade, because in fourth grade, you start to, you don't learn to read any longer, you read to learn. And so when they get to that point at the end of third grade, they really need to learn to know how to read. My fifth grader's kindergarten teacher said something to me that's always stayed with me. She said that no matter what program you have, a third of her class would get it the way she taught it. A third of her class would eventually get it the way she taught it, and a third would not. And if she changed the program around and did it differently, it would still come out the same. And my son was the one who wasn't getting it the way it was being taught. It was being taught very creatively, very enriched. They would read wonderful stories. But if you don't know that letters make sounds, none of that really helps you learn to read. So he has come a long way. He still struggles. But it has helped him in other ways besides reading. He now knows that he's good at math because he couldn't read the instructions. He couldn't read the word problems. And so it helps so much beyond reading for him. I think he's labeled himself very early, and I think many kids do, as not being smart. And that stays with them so long. And other kids and other people will label them too, but it's the label you give yourself that matters the most. I hope he's coming out of that. I hope that as he achieves in other areas, that label will disappear. But I think it's very hard to see yourself differently. I'm also a reading tutor. After my son was in the system in first grade, I started training as a Sunday reading tutor. I tutor at his school, and I also tutor at Green Elementary School, and which is a Minnesota Reading Corps group. I tutor mainly pre-reading skills, so in kindergarten. I'll even start with shapes, letters, colors, down to the very basics. And then we start to bring them into phonics. And I have seen so many children, I just see that light go on. They come in and they know how to sing the alphabet, but they don't know what that means. It's a song to them. And then they see that those letters are connected to shapes, and those shapes form sounds. And you can see the light just switch on sometimes. I had a little girl last year, and she could say her alphabet, and she could point out the letters, and she could say her sounds. But when she figured out that those sounds could be put together to make a word, it was just like she just took off. And that was the beginning of her reading. And now she's doing great. She's reading at grade level and moving on and beyond grade level. But it needs to find a way to help that one-third of kids. And at my son's school, it's pulling them out and teaching them in a different way. It's a very systematic way, very this says this, these are the rules. And so for some kids, that's not the way. But I think the schools need to be flexible enough to see that if it's not possible to teach them in the class, then pulling them out and having the resources as tutors to help that third of a kid is really essential, because you can't leave a third behind.
Thanks. My name is Rachel Sherman, and I also have two kids in the on the Barton Public School, and one's 8, one's 9. My 9-year-old had no trouble with reading. She could probably read Tolstoy now at age 9, and my son can't read Cat in the Hat, and he's just 17 months younger, or couldn't read Cat in the Hat, I should say. He actually has been pulled out into one of these special reading programs, and I was sort of pushing the school because I recognized very early on that he was not getting it, but, you know, everybody gives you this rap that he's a boy, he'll catch on, and there's this range at which they pick up this stuff, which is probably true, but at the same time, they start to feel really badly about themselves while they're in the bottom end of that range. And so he started describing everybody else as smart and himself as dumb, and he gets very uptight about reading and has had a very hard time with it. And he's a kid, again, with, I don't think, any developmental disabilities at all. He's a very bright kid. He just wasn't learning the way they were teaching. I think the class size is also a problem. I don't think anybody's mentioned that. But with 30 kids in a classroom, you know, the teachers are stretched to the limit. And so it's only really the squeaky wheels that get heard, and I had to keep going back to his teacher. And I think she looks at my husband and I as, you know, kind of we have a very attentive household. Both of us bring our kids to school. You know, we're both academics. We're completely into this intellectual life. So she kept thinking, well, we don't have to worry. He's in this environment. But I knew he wasn't picking up basic patterns. He'd bring home these spelling words. You know, for the kids who are not picking up reading, they give you a list of words like cat, hat, sat, mat, and he would read or try to read each one as if it were a completely new concept. He would never recognize that he just said cat and that mat had something to do with cat, the sound. He just couldn't recognize those patterns. So luckily, I kept pushing, and I actually wasn't able to get into this Sunday program because I don't think I was loud enough early enough. And my understanding is there wasn't enough space. So finally, I guess I kept bothering our wonderful reading specialist, and she assessed him at the beginning of third grade, pulled him out, and he's been in intensive reading classes just with like 8 other kids and this woman, Karen Emerson, who's fantastic. And she's brought his level up from about low first grade to probably high second or low third in 4 months, and it's remarkable. I mean, here's a kid who couldn't pick up Dr. Seuss, and now he's struggling through, but at least he's, you know, confident enough to struggle through these chapter books like Cam Jansen. Not the whole book, but a piece at a time. And so I've been really pleased with the progress that he's been able to make. I wrote a bunch of comments. I'll just give them to you because a lot of people have said it. But one of the things that's really struck me just watching this session is these incredible women and these, you know, mothers who are just willing to drop their careers and devote it to their kids. And it's phenomenal. And I think that what that really has to bring our attention to is the fact that there's a lot of parents who can't do that. You know, many of us are in, you know, solid middle class, two-parent families where we can afford to do that one way or another. But there's a heck of a lot of people who are not in this room today who you know, are completely unable, and I think we really have a social obligation to try to bring this diversity of learning systems into the schools and make them available for those kids, because the teachers, as somebody pointed out, or a few people pointed out, can pick out pretty quickly who needs that kind of help. And, you know, this having two children that are so completely different, both very bright but in different ways, has made me very aware that we don't all learn the same way, and we have to make more than one way accessible to the kids, as you just said. So let's see if there's any. Oh, one last point. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, and I guess partly because I read hundreds of bad student papers a year. There's some really good ones, too. But I am just obsessed about reading, because I feel like the kids who read and read a lot and read well write well because they've figured out how to do it. And the kids who don't read and are not pushed to read and who are not given the special help, they can't write in a sentence in English. And we're talking about the college level, and it's really distressing to me. So I put a lot of emphasis on this early intervention because I think it makes such a difference, and I'm praying that it's going to make a difference for my little boy as he goes through the system. So, you know, I think it's a really great investment if the state of Minnesota can make it to do this, because we end up with a much bigger problem later on that I just can't fix when the kid's 21 years old, you know, something that he or she could have picked up 18 years before. So anyway, that's all I have really to
Thank
say.
You so much.
Sure.
All three of you. Thank you very much. We're going to hear from some students now. Daniel Thompson, Mackenzie Erickson, Matthew Schmidt, would you join us at the table? And Senator Saltzman.
Yes. I just want to let the students know we're just delighted to have you here today, and I'm very impressed that you're here, because you are certainly watching democracy in action, but your testimony is very important to us. We want you to feel really comfortable, and we're just delighted to have you here. So thank you so much for coming today.
I'll go first.
Okay. Just each of you say your name for the record,
okay,
for the tape. And
hi, my name is Daniel Thompson. I am in 7th grade at Orno Middle School. Reading for me when I was growing up was really, really hard. It took me 2 years to learn the alphabet. I was behind and the other kids in my kindergarten class in reading, and Arnold did help me with this reading program known as Linda Mood Bell, which I took in my special ed class. And every day after school, even in the summer, I came home and my mom gave me reading instructions and helped me. I did this through 2nd grade. Then around 3rd grade, I started to pick up really fast, and like I was on an assembly line. And by the end of 3rd grade, I was reading at grade level. And then by the end of 5th grade, my teacher gave a comprehension test and found I was reading at a 9th grade level, and that I read 200 words per minute, which is faster than my mom. I try and read about 2 books a month, and I enjoy reading.
It's wonderful.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Mackenzie Erickson. I graduated from Southwest High School, which is a Minneapolis public school, this past spring in 2007. I always like to say it would appear that I have no problems. If you weren't my English teacher, you would never know. I have a lot of credibility, and I don't like to share it, but I think it's very important for people to understand where I'm coming from. I was student body president. I was in the National Honor Society, which requires at least a 3.5 GPA. I did all the service projects. I come from a very rich environment. You heard my mom earlier. And none of my peers knew unless I told them, or for some reason there was a very embarrassing moment in class. And it was really striking to me that no one really got it around me. None of my peers and none of my teachers really understood. They said, you know, you're a white middle-class girl, you're student body president, how are you not reading at grade level? And how can you rely on spell check so much? So I want to say, when I transitioned to middle school, I realized that the role of special ed changed. It switched away from teaching me how to read and switched to helping me pass and get along in my classroom. And that was a really big deal and a really large change, because when I transitioned to middle school in sixth grade, I was reading at a fourth grade level. And although I continued to improve, this was kind of the cutoff. This was like, you know, they switched away from helping me improve myself and more to just kind of surviving in the mainstream. So my family fought, and actually in third grade I had started private tutoring. I have seen, or third through 12th grade, I saw an Orton Gillingham private tutor. And that was the choice of the Minneapolis Public Schools, to bring in a private tutor 2 to 3 times a week instead of train a classroom teacher or a special ed teacher. And I guess that's my main point today, is that everybody can benefit from learning reading through Orton Gillingham. And it's a financial situation as well. I think a lot of us are invested because we just want our kids to read, or we just want to learn how to read. But for the sake of the state and the sake of the whole educational system, it's really important to realize that we need to make the investment in certifying our teachers and our special ed teachers in order for everybody to benefit. And because we can all do the math, if I saw a private tutor for 9 years, 2 to 3 times a week, it's definitely cheaper to just certify a special ed teacher.
Great. So. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, my name is Matthew Schmidt. Never really done this before, so it's going to be kind of weird if I do something really kind of strange, so forgive me for that.
Don't worry about it, Matthew. You'll do fine.
I'm just kind of here. I have dyslexia and dysgraphia, and I'm just kind of here to say, really, that how hard it was for me to kind of get through the school, because I was evaluated in first grade, and I didn't get help. I didn't actually even get help till fourth grade, and and with the reading program they had me in, it wasn't actually appropriate for at-risk readers. So. You know, that's what they call it. And I was only progressing 3 months each year. And then my mom and dad got really upset with them because they had asked them to try a different reading program, and they flat out refused the district. Sorry, 1 second. Oh, yes. I had also been in this program for the last 3 years. And so,
doing great, by the way, Matt.
Yes. Thank you.
Doing better than a lot of the other people who come and talk to us.
My parents had, there was an Orton Gillingham, I went to an Orton Gillingham tutor over the summer, and after only 18 hours of tutoring, it was for 18 lessons, 1 hour each lesson, I gained a year and I think it was a year and 2 months just for 18 hours, other than 3 months for a whole year of school. And this is the Orton-Gillingham program. So then my parents showed them these test results, and sorry, I'm kind of all over the place. After a while, my parents just kept fighting them to ask them to just try and just give me something I could use to help me, more like, you know, assistive technology and better reading programs and stuff. My parents just gave up, and I'm homeschooled now. So now I have a tutor comes to my house every day. Well, not every day. It's three times a day. Three times a week, and she teaches me in the Wilson program, which is very similar to the reading last program I just mentioned.
Yeah.
Oh man, I'm
the Orton-Gillingham. Huh?
Orton-Gillingham. Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Those aren't words that just come naturally flowing off your tongue, so don't worry about that.
All right, and I've already progressed to the reading levels in this program, and I always was, And what also made, there's something that really made me feel really angry about the school district, because they never didn't seem to really care, really, if I failed or not. They were just trying to deal with me to get through me till I would graduate, they wouldn't have to deal with me anymore. It was something that they didn't actually want to try and help. They were just something I had, it was just part of their job.
Mm-hmm.
So, was that, and there was something when I was in the car coming over, I just thought of something. This is, because when I was in school, it was my first day of seventh grade. I was in the middle school, so, and they had everyone come in the lunchroom, and we were all talking, and the principal said that you couldn't have any electronic stuff inside the building. So I'm like, well, okay. But then, I don't really remember his name, but he was blind. His name was, I think it was like Cody or something. Don't really remember. And he said that he needed this, I don't remember really what it was, but he had this big tape box like thing that he would carry around, and he would kind of, it was something for reading. So, and I thought to myself, when I was here, I was thinking, If you're kind of saying a dyslexic, you're saying that they can go without like reading program, a special reading program, kind of like what my school was doing. It's basically kind of like you're taking away, you're expecting a blind person to read something, you know, normal, or just not normal, but you know, something, yeah, normal, just print. You know. Well, yeah, it's kind of pretty much it. So.
Yeah.
I'm all over the place. So.
That's all right.
Well, thank you anyway.
You're welcome. Thank you, Matthew. What year in school are you now?
I'm ninth grader.
Ninth grade. Great. Well, wonderful. Thank you, all three of you, for sharing your story. Senator Saltzman.
Yes. You know, last February, I believe, Mackenzie, you came and spoke to the Senate Education Finance Committee. We were across the hall in the other room. And I remember at the end of your testimony, Senator Stumpf, who was the chair of that committee, said to you, well, when did you start in special ed? And your response said all. You said, well, I had to wait until third grade until I had fallen far enough behind.
Yes.
And that resonated with everyone at that table. And hearing from students is so very powerful. because this is what this is all about. We're here to hear today about these experiences, because stories truly paint the problem, but they also paint the solution for us. So thank you so much. You were very brave to be here. You made a lot of sense to us, so thank you so much.
Thank you. Again. Now we have representatives of the Groves Academy program. Dr. Alexander and Carrie, and is it Emmy?
It is.
Emmy Thompson.
Is it okay if Emmy gives it a try first yet?
Go ahead. Yeah. Wait, whoever wants to start. Just say your name for the record. And
okay. My name is Emmy Thompson. I'm 12 years old, and it's my birthday today.
Well, happy birthday. Happy birthday.
Just read this.
Can you pull the mic, just align it better so we be sure we don't miss anything you say?
I'm a 12-year-old dyslexic. When I was little, my friends would read a lot better than me, and I felt I was dumb. My mom would always say that you're not dumb, but I would always argue and say, no, Mama, I am stupid, and I would get frustrated. I felt like a lot of my teachers didn't think I was smart, even the reading specialist at school. She told me once in front of the other kids, Emmy, you just need to pick up the pace. It made me angry and sad because I couldn't pick up the pace because I just couldn't read. My mom told me after that I didn't need to go to a reading specialist. I didn't need to go to her class anymore, and we got a special reading tutor and I had some testing done at the Alexander Center. That's when I found out I wasn't dumb. Actually, they said I was really smart and that I just needed to be taught to read in a different way. They told me I had a learning disability called dyslexia. That's when we found Groves Academy. I left my Minnetonka school and went to Groves in third grade. I stayed there for 3 years. At Groves, they have a different kind of reading instruction. It's called Wilson. Wilson books go up to 12 levels. The books get harder as you go on. I started at book one when I first got to Groves. You can start at any level. It depends on how well you read. I am at level 9.6 in Wilson today. And every week I tutor to learn more in the program. I will keep working to learn Wilson because it helps me. Today I am in sixth grade. I just transitioned to Ornell Middle School this year. The number of kids in sixth grade is smaller than my Minnetonka school, and most of the teachers understand my dyslexia and how I learn. Instead of choir, band, and study hall, I go to Skills. The Skills room is for people that have learning disabilities and who are on IEPs. During tests, I can go to the Skills room or I can stay in the classroom. Some of my tests are modified, like they can be read to me. In my first quarter, I got A's in all my classes, including English, math, social studies, and science. I do a lot of homework. I'm really good at math, but social studies is not my favorite class. Today, I can read anything, but it takes me a longer time than some of my friends. How fast you read is important, and it's one of the things I'm still working on. But now I can read well, really well. And I like to read, but only good books. I'm here because I think all kids like me should have instructions that will help them learn to read well and not have to be so hard, sad, and frustrated. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Very well. Very well done.
I'm Carrie Thompson. That's a great job, Emmy. Emmy's my daughter. I have to tell you that I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone here, but sitting here and listening to Emmy do this, I have no right to be there. She's amazing. This would not have happened 3.5 years ago, to have her sit here and read something in front of total strangers that she doesn't even know. So I'm very proud of you, just I'd say that. It's easier for me when I read, so I apologize if I'm not looking at you, but I'm just going to read what I've put down here.
That's perfectly all right.
I want to thank you all for inviting us here today. It's a huge honor, and we're very pleased to be here. My name is Carrie Thompson, and I'm a single mom to 3 beautiful treasures from China. Emmy is my oldest. 3.5 years ago, I was just a mom and a small business owner. Today, I am a mom, a small business owner, a member of my local school district's Special Education Advisory Council, a board member for the International Dyslexia Association Upper Midwest Branch, a member of our local Parent Advocates for Students with Dyslexia group, and a tireless advocate for effective reading instruction. As a family, we began this journey in the spring of 2004 when Emmy was diagnosed with significant dyslexia. Although she had a very high IQ, she was reading far below grade level, and it was beginning to dramatically impact her self-esteem. For 3 solid months after the diagnosis, I took time off, and I had the luxury to do that, and researched everything I could about effective instruction for struggling readers, and I came across 2 important findings. The 5 components identified by the National Reading Panel's report on effective reading instruction, including phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension, and the groundbreaking neurological research of Dr. Sally Shaywitz. And she wrote this book, Overcoming Dyslexia. Her book is regarding the efficacy of scientifically based reading instruction that relies upon the very 5 same strands. Both discoveries changed the course of Emmy's life, and I would argue my own. After a frustrating battle to secure an individualized education plan with our local school district, we finally received an IEP, but we failed to get Emmy the explicit, direct reading instruction she required based on the research that I knew. We left our district to enroll her at Groves Academy, which, lucky for us, happened to be 15 minutes down the road. And that was that following fall. At Groves, she found success almost immediately, and maybe more importantly, she rediscovered her sense of self-worth as she quickly began to learn to read. In fact, she gained nearly 3 full academic years in reading in just her first year at Groves. That's startling. After 3 years of reading instruction, focusing on the 5 components using an explicit, systematic, and sequential reading program, Emmy acquired a solid foundation of reading skills that would allow her to be successful back in a public school setting. And this fall, she was open enrolled at Orono Middle School. She has been meeting the rigorous demands, and I'm saying they are rigorous, of 6th grade. She comes home from school at about 3:30, and oftentimes she's still doing homework at 10:30 at night. She's a competitive swimmer, so she does do a little bit of swimming a few days, 5 days a week. But between the swimming and the homework, she's a busy kid. She is meeting those rigorous demands both academically and socially. I'm confident that Emmy will succeed. In fact, I can't wait to see where she lands in life. However, there are far too many kids just like Emmy who are struggling to read and struggling to find their own self-worth. I've witnessed effective reading instruction taught by true professionals that understand the importance of teaching the five components of effective reading instruction in a direct, explicit, and systematic way. There are those terms again. You've heard those quite a bit. And I've seen it firsthand. The evidence is conclusive. With the right instruction, all kids can learn to read and read well. I am one of those many moms on a mission. And I am here today not just for Emmy, but for those children who may never reach their full potential without effective reading instruction. And I thank you for allowing us to share that story.
Thank you, Carrie. Dr. Alexander.
Okay. Hi, my name is John Alexander. I'm the head of school at Groves Academy over in St. Louis Park. Groves is a small independent school for students between the grades of 1st through 12th, most of whom, the vast majority, have a specific language disability, otherwise known as dyslexia, the struggling readers. This is my 20th year in the field of reading, and for about the last 15 years or so, I've been very involved in teacher training for the teaching of reading on both coasts, both in Vermont and California, and now I found myself centered here in the Midwest. So I think I can speak from a broad perspective, and my experiences on both coasts are mirrored fairly closely with what I see here in Minnesota. I hold a graduate degree in reading from Harvard University. I studied with one of the preeminent reading researchers in the history of reading research, Jean Chaw. She's since passed away. I've also had the good fortune of working closely with one, the now leading researcher, I believe, in the country, Louisa Motz, Dr. Louisa Motz. And with her, I've teacher trained. I've also taught at the graduate level reading classes, and am very involved now in the reading task force in the state of Minnesota. And don't tell my board of trustees, but I've effectively resigned from Groves to pursue reading research and to be a wannabe policymaker in reading. I've really devoted a great deal of my time over the last 6 months in particular to the reading task force to try to generate policy that will affect good instruction for our teachers in the state. And I think that unfortunately there is not the trickle-down from the National Reading Panel recommendations that came out in 2000 to our teacher training programs, our teacher education programs. And so we do a lot of training on the back end. Specifically, we train teachers in Orton-Gillingham. We partner with Orton-Gillingham, Minnesota, a terrific organization here in the Twin Cities. And we're involved in teacher training in Orton-Gillingham in both the summer and during the school year. We pass about 70 teachers through a year. And I think the thing that we hear overwhelmingly in our evaluations from the teachers is why haven't I learned this in my undergrad programs? It's frustrating to me as a taxpayer also that we have tax money going into public universities for ostensibly teacher training and teacher education. We're paying on the front end, and then in very good programs like Reading First that are now being implemented in 24 schools or have been implemented in 24 schools across the state, where in effect federal dollars are going to train teachers after the fact, after they've been through teacher education programs. And that shouldn't be. My bias really in hiring has been I'd rather hire a very strong liberal arts major and train them from the ground up in the right pedagogy and to teach reading and teach literacy than to hire people coming out of schools of ed who have preconceived and misinformed ideas about how to teach reading. So fortunately, we have here in the Twin Cities a really good graduate program, University of St. Thomas, which has as part of their grad program in special education, though, not in their main education program, an Orton-Gillingham both coursework and practicum that they have to take.
So just a question. I just want to, just on that point, because you picked a sign that I think is key to all this, is that what we're striving for here is that these interventions should not be in special ed. They need to be in the general curriculum. I think if you could just elaborate a little bit on that in case anyone watches this tape later on.
Yes.
That's, I think, very important that we're struggling with this across the state because it's still getting kind of pushed into special ed. And again, then you have to qualify for special education.
That's a good point. And I was coming down the road to that. Good reading instruction is good reading instruction. No matter whether it's for the struggling reader or for the emerging reader. And the evidence is the same. In fact, if you go through the 600 pages of the National Reading Panel's recommendations and studies, you'll see that they're talking about reading instruction for all children. That we know that this is a systematic, direct, explicit, research-based program that will bring all readers to the end result faster than if we don't teach in this manner. So that's a very, very good point, and one that we really need to be cognizant of. One of the struggles, and Susan Thompson was absolutely right, it's very, very difficult and very hard work on this task force. It is one of the most difficult things I've been involved in professionally. And I think too often the whole field of reading gets portrayed into camps, whole language camp and phonics camp. And we have to look at what the research says. And it has to be research-based, scientifically-based research instruction. And if we do that and we hold to what the research shows us, we shouldn't be divided. And I just want to end by showing to you that the five strands themselves, while critically important and demonstrably shown in these studies that children have to have this in order to be good readers. And the five strands, again, are phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension, that alone is not enough. Teachers have to have an explicit understanding of the structures of language. And I'd like to give you a couple of examples to show you that, because I think it'll make a lot of sense. And I'll tell you without a doubt, having looked at large number of college reading syllabi and course descriptions, that these underlying structures of language are not being addressed in our teacher education programs. I can say that unequivocally. Let me give you an example. And one of the other tenets of good instruction is multisensory, so I'm going to be multisensory with you now. Phonemic awareness is the ability of an individual, we'll say a child in this case, to segment and manipulate the sounds within a word. So Nancy earlier gave testimony about k, at, not k, at, t. That's mispronounced, and kids will never learn to spell if teachers mispronounce cat, its component sounds. But we know that in the end of kindergarten, beginning of first grade, that if a child cannot take the spoken word unit, cat, which is a one sound unit, cat, we don't go around saying, did you see the cat in the corner? It's a very inefficient way to disseminate language and knowledge. So it's a one spoken word utterance. If a child cannot decompose that word into its three component sounds, it is virtually impossible for them to take an abstract alphabetic representation, the letter, the grapheme, and map it to those sounds. So for kids who struggle, and we have standardized tests out there that show that we can give to students in kindergarten to see if they're at risk with phonemic awareness. So if we find a student who is at risk, we don't even want to bother with the abstraction of the alphabet or the grapheme, the letter sound correspondence. We want to work just at the sound level. So we might do something like this. I may say to the child, the green block represents a. Can you show me a? The child will put a green block up. A. Good. The yellow block represents t. Can you show me t? T. Good. Can you now show me, with what you just learned, can you show me at? So we'd want the child to say a. Great. This represents k, not c. K. Can you show me cat? K, a, t. Great. Can you show me tack? T, a, k. Not spelling, just sounds. Now, that was done very quickly. A child who struggles with phonemic awareness, you'd have to go very slowly through this to get them to do that. But this just manipulating sounds. We'd also want to do a lot of rhyming with them. We'd want to do deletion of sounds. Can you say cowboy without the boy? Cow. That's all phonemic awareness exercises. Can you slime without the s? Lime. That's another deletion exercise. So this is a structure of language at the very base level, the sound level, that if teachers don't have this explicit awareness of what's going on, it's virtually impossible for them to impart that knowledge to the student who's struggling. And I can tell you from my experience working with teachers coming out of the undergrad programs and graduate programs in regular ed, they don't have that awareness. Let me give you another example. We believe very strongly in the Orton-Gillingham, Wilson, or Lindemood methods that we have to teach directly, explicitly, and sequentially, starting from the very base and building up. So we will actually have the child learn that the letter C is associated, and this is a very young non-reader, emerging reader, the letter C has a keyword cat, and the letter C makes a k sound. So the child sees C, sees this visual, C, cat, k, and he'll trace it for the multisensory effect, for that kinesthetic effect. Well, that's great. We'll do a whole list of words with k, C at the beginning of the word so that they can make that generalization. But what happens when C, excuse me, what happens when C, all of a sudden, in this word, what would a child say? Well, this is kitty. He's learned kitty. But an underlying structure rule of the language is that C before I, E, or Y always says S. So we have to teach this explicitly as well. Teachers coming out of our programs don't know this, and they need to know this. This is phonics, another structure of language, one of the five components. The last thing example I'd like to give you is a phonological example. It's not one of the five strands, but it's an underlying language structure that is as important to the teaching of reading and spelling as the five strands. Now we're really starting to get underneath what makes this all work. This is a very common spelling error of an emerging speller or reader or a dyslexic or struggling. Now, you're lucky. Sometimes if you're lucky, you'll get a vowel, but often not. When I do, I give talks at the national level, at the state level, at the local level, and when I give this talk and I ask the audience what this child intended to spell, the two answers that I get most often are grass and grease. but neither is correct. When I do this with teacher trainers, people as a teacher trainer, with people coming out of schools of ed and ask them what the child is spelled, I would expect a teacher to be able to tell me what error was made. The teachers will tell me grass or grease. The word that the child intended to spell was dress. And the reason for this is a phonological reason, because we do not say the word dress as component speech sounds. We do not say d-s. We say dress. Because the R sound, r, is affecting the D. It's making us round our mouth to say it. So kids will make this type of an error, G for D, when it's followed by an R. This is not a random error. This is a predictable error, and we have to understand where it's coming from. Let me give you one more example before I close. And hopefully that lesson you can generalize to this lesson. Same thing going on here. This is a phonological error. This is something our teachers of reading and spelling at first, second, and third grade level should be able to tell us where this error is coming from. But they can't, by and large. What word do you think that this child was trying to spell? And don't think about it in terms of what it looks like, but what it sounds like.
Train.
Any guesses?
Train.
Train. That's it. That's the word the child intended. And the issue here is the same, because we do not say train. We say train. Listen to yourself as you pronounce the word train. And that's a very predictable error. Okay? We need to know how to correct it. We have to know, before we can correct it, we need to recognize it. And we are not recognizing, our teachers in elementary school are not recognizing that error. And if they can't recognize it, how can you fix it? So we need to have this explicit understanding. And these are I'm just skimming the surface. Okay, I could spend 2 weeks with you going through the structures of language that we need to teach teachers to teach. But there is an incredible disconnect, in my humble opinion, between what teachers need to know and what we're providing them in the undergraduate and graduate levels and teacher preparation programs. And until that changes, we are going to continue, in my opinion, we are going to continue to see 60% of our kids not reading at proficiency. And I'll tell you, of those, the 60% not reading at proficiency, only 10% of them will have a diagnosed learning disability, a reading disability. 90% of our kids who are not reading at grade level are instructional casualties. Instructional casualties. Okay, and until we correct that and until our higher ed sees that and does something about it, we are doomed. And I would be happy to come back. I have an entire presentation on the economic impact of not learning to read that goes to our jail systems, to the unproductivity of people who don't reach their potentials and are on the tax dollar. The problem is legion. And it's now we have an opportunity. I do at some level share Susan's optimism that, I mean, the problem is out on the table. And now it's up to us to do something. And I don't think it's going to happen on its own. I don't think it's going to happen from the schools or the higher ed institutions across this country on their own.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alexander. It was hearing you make a presentation a little bit lengthier than this a year ago that lit my fire. I mean, I've recognized that need, that there's more that needs to be done, and had the frustration, but I think you added some clarity to it, and I really appreciate the mission that you're on that really is attempting to put your own institution out of business.
Yep. Ideally, that would be great. As long as somebody would hire me somewhere, I'd be
You do have transferable skills. Wonderful. Thank you very much, Senator Saltzman.
Yes, just I'd like to ask Senate Counsel to come to the table and to read what we currently have in statute regarding the Board of Teaching. And just as a point of information, and obviously we have work to do, but I just want to just have this sort of as a point of information for us today. Thank you, Ms. Jenkins, for being here.
Madam Chair, members, the statute requires, it's actually 122A.18, subdivision 2A, it's reading strategies. And all college and university programs that are approved by the Board of Teaching to prepare persons for a classroom teacher license, the programs have to include research-based best practices in reading that's consistent with the definition that we have in statute, which defines what we believe is comprehensive, scientifically-based reading instructions, which includes the five areas of reading that were mentioned earlier in the testimony.
And, excuse me, Madam Chair, just one point here is that we currently have in statute that this has to be included, but we do not have in statute that they have to prove competency in this area. That seems to be, I mean, in my humble opinion, seems to be something that may be an issue. And not to, I think it's an opportunity. I think that we will be pursuing this topic. So I thank you so much for your testimony today. And Kimmy, happy birthday to you. I hope this has been a great way to start off the day, but sort of a coming of age to be testifying before the Senate in Minnesota. So that is great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Jenkins, for providing that background.
We have a parochial school program and language learning center, Kathleen Ogle.
I see. We have this for you. And I'm going to cut down what I'm saying.
Okay, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
My name is Kathy Ogle, and I'm from Faribault, Minnesota. And my son Matthew's story has been told many, many times today. He is a dyslexic, and he's very successful. He is a CEO of his own medical device company, and he teaches classes in entrepreneurship at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's 35 years old now. And this article I've given you is from a current magazine or publication from the University of Minnesota. So I'll skip his article because I was so proud of his article, and it's just coming to press now. But what I'm really excited about, I won't tell you his story, but for the past 20 years, I've had the good fortune of working in this grade school, the parochial school that he went to in Faribault. And on one of the pages that has the picture at the bottom, it tells the demographics of Faribault. I'll skip that, and also the demographics of our school, except to tell you that there it is a pre-K through grade 6 school. And in kindergarten through grade 6, there are 284 students. So it's not like a real tiny private school. It is like a grade school with two classrooms for each grade. I'm excited because the classroom teachers here teach Project Read. And when I learned the Orton-Gillingham program at the Reading Center in Rochester, there were two guest speakers, Dr. Mary Lee Ann Field from Bloomington and Tori Green. And they began in the early 1970s, late 1960s. Dr. Enfield got her PhD from the University of Minnesota. And what they did was they studied Orton-Gillingham in Rochester, came back to the Bloomington Public Schools, and put this program in place in their classrooms because they made the observation that almost all the kids who were being referred for special education ended up in that lowest reading group. So they said, why don't we teach, instead of having these kids pulled out for special ed, why don't we teach them in the classroom? And that's how they put Orton-Gillingham into the classroom. So they have been doing that in Bloomington since the early 1970s. And we've been using the program at our school for the past 20 years. And it involves a lot of teacher training. So the classroom teachers teach Project Read to students at our school in small group settings in the regular classroom. For at least, I said in this report, 30 minutes a day, but I know, like our really good teachers, will teach them about 45 minutes a day. So they are getting a lot of this, and it's a part of their educational diet. It's not something they have to go out of the classroom to get. It's just a normal part of being a student. It's just like the kids aren't thought of as any different. In fact, they have the fun group for reading because these kids do a lot of multisensory activities, and they have puppets, or they really have the fun way of learning. And so the other kids are behind their little desks, and they're all learning by peeking over at this group that's having a lot of fun learning. These students make up 20 to 30% of the students in each of our first through third grade classrooms. They participate in language and reading instruction from the BASEL in a whole group setting each day. This gives them exposure to literature and vocabulary with that whole group. And in their small group setting, the Project Read students are directly taught the parts of our language. For example, they say, this is the letter A. The letter A makes the A sound. So in Project Read, they use a lot of hand signals and body language. So the A is cued that way. A is found in the word am. And I've got the word am in my hand. So they don't teach the skill in isolation. It's immediately put into a word. The word am is a-m, and this is finger blending and finger spelling. So the child can isolate the a sound. This is a, and then it's immediately put into a sentence. I am the parent of a dyslexic. So that's just a little snapshot of some of the techniques. Nothing is left for guessing. Students are taught directly, following a sequence of skills, which you've heard all along today. And in Project Read, there are just wonderful multisensory techniques and body language for processing. Project Read provides the preventive program that's needed to supply an educational diet every day, this diet, for students at risk of the handicapping condition of illiteracy. I have written for grants for teacher training for these last 20 years, and I know that the key to successful teaching is having teachers empowered with knowledge to teach all students in their classroom. Don't push them out. Include them. If they're pushed out, they still come back to the classroom. And so the classroom teacher really needs to understand this student every day. And if they're subtracted from her group for an hour or something, it doesn't make any difference. She still has them as a learner afterwards. What also excites me is that in the past 5 years, our school has taught Project Read phonics in kindergarten to all of our kindergarten students. There isn't a separated group. Every kindergarten student receives this type of teaching. This program gives our students the necessary, detailed, explicit, initial foundation for phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and text comprehension. And in the picture that you have in the handout, you see a kindergarten teacher, and she is having the kids trace. Part of the multisensory is tracing that letter W, and so you can see her in a small group. This is what a small group would look like. In kindergarten, the kids give Project Read in whole group and small group so that they get it all day long. They are fractioned off into small groups and are kind of mixed up so that they aren't like ability grouped. But the teachers really easily can see in kindergarten the kids who are struggling to learn letter names, letter sounds. So they're really beginning to get a good idea of the kids who are struggling. Actually, we have two pre-kindergarten teachers. We have 64 pre-K kids. We've had all-day kindergarten for many, many years. I'm sure it's over 15 years. So our kindergarten teachers have the luxury of a whole day. We have 64 pre-K students, and both of those teachers are also taught in the Project Read training so that they have the vocabulary that's coming into Project Read, and they have the understanding of how to teach this, to teach our language explicitly and really early. Each year, I pre- and post-test the students in grade 1 through 3 who receive the Project Read intervention in order to monitor their progress in reading. Following is a summary of Woodcock Reading Mastery Test results for our grade 2 Project Read students done this past fall at my school. So the next page you'll see just a little summary. Actually, in this second grade, we have 11 students out of 42 total who are receiving the Project Read intervention. And so that would be 26% of our students. So I would argue that if you have, now everyone today is saying like 30%. If you have about 30% of kids in every classroom, it's not a small number. And that the teachers really should know how to deal with such a large number of students. It's not just one or two, believe me. Over the 20 years, I've consistently seen up to 30%. So you can see just the graph there, how well the students are doing. And these are the at-risk students. They were on grade 2.1, so the X's show you how close they are to grade level. And the student, I'd say, who's out of range, down here in Passage Comp, that student, actually, we have trouble getting our kids to qualify for special ed in our district because we're teaching them so well. They don't qualify. We barely get kids to qualify for Title I. I think we may have 4 kids this year who will qualify. We are a Title I school, and we just have a great deal. We can't get the kids into those programs because we are really teaching well.
Mm-hmm. So on that point, I've had some parents who have called me that are concerned about my work in this area because I'm going to deny their children the right to special ed.
Right.
And I've tried to explain to them, well, would it be better that your child is at a higher achievement level, or would you rather that your child be farther behind just so that they get special ed? Trying to explain that these interventions are maybe more effective than what they would get under a special ed program. Could you briefly address that?
Well, because, I agree because with you're you, saying that, of course.
Right.
Because actually, if this is in place, education is going to look different. Right now, we have special education people who are really vested in. There's like a finance, a money flow going there. People have been trained. They have all the belief and thinking about pulling kids out. But there probably has to be a big thinking change in education, and that's what I've seen for 20 years. You can put this in place in a classroom, and it'll look different. It'll really look different because you see on the chart, those kids don't fail in reading. They don't have to, and they shouldn't have to because they should be honored as learners, really. Does that answer? That's my opinion. You might see a big change in the way education looks. The next page I gave you, just some notes from what I saw on those 11 students' tests. So you've got a good sense of that, all the different problems the kids had. That's what our son Matt looked like in second grade. And when he went to the reading center and he was diagnosed there also, he couldn't remember the word the. And my husband, who's a physician, said that was when the light went on. You know, how many times has Matthew been told the word the, seen the word the, and couldn't remember it? So I guess I'm here today to submit that this type of strong teaching will aid students like our son Matthew in order that they can develop their great, great potential. And you see by the article, and I actually thank you very much. And I want to say that Project Read is in the Minnesota area. It is a national program. There are thousands of schools all over the country using this program. They have more than the phonics. I would say, sadly, for our school, we only focus on the phonics, which everybody's talking about today. But because these kids benefit from direct instruction of skills, they should really be directly taught writing. They need to be directly taught comprehension skills. So that there's like I said, we should see this wonderful change in education, and I think this is a great beginning. Phonics is a great beginning, but there's a lot more that can happen in reading and language arts training. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Well, we're to the last point, the options for struggling readers, and we have a long list of people. Why don't I invite you all to come up to the table, and we're going a little bit long. Maybe if each of you could identify some of the unique things about your ideas that they either reinforce or may not unduly repeat what we've been hearing. Kind of come up to the table, but if there's not room, join the sit at the table here too, because the microphones are all working. So we have Gretchen, Natalie, Michael, Maggie, Rebecca, and Kate.
My name is first, so I guess I'll begin. I'm Gretchen Vroeg. I have three children in the Minnetonka school system. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Eighth grader, seventh grader, and fourth grader. My bookends, as I refer to them, are the ones with what I would call delayed in reading. The other middle child seemed like he was a born professor. My situation was that in the fourth and fifth grade, my fourth grader was tackling The Lord of the Rings, and my fifth grader was parked way back in what was appropriate for a first grader. I was very confused, and I was constantly listening to my intuition saying, this doesn't sit with me right. I know this kid is really bright. So what can I do? And so I turned to my schools. At the time, we were living in a very affluent community in suburban New York City, which has a very high-powered system and very well-known for their special ed. I don't think they listened to me because I don't think he was a severe enough of a case, but I wouldn't let it go. I just kept going, and I continued to be curious and a little picky and really wanting to have understanding and knowledge of why were these two kids so radically different, though parked way high up in that one third where, yep, they got it the first time around, and the other one parked in that other third where I knew he was bright, but it just didn't resonate in his brain. So I continued to press for where he was evaluated in New York by a psychoeducational evaluator. So we're going through the process and so forth. We moved to Minnesota, where I'm from. I got tired of the East Coast. And so we moved. I begged my husband to go back to Minnesota and its great folk. And we did indeed go down to the Reading Center down in Rochester. I was very impressed by their passion. And I did find an Orton-Gillingham tutor, but I felt very impatient. I wasn't getting enough because 2 hours a week was not enough for me. I felt so impatient. And somebody who I wish I could remember who said it, Linda Mood Bell moved into Minnesota. I went, oh, I know that name. I've heard great things. And I don't want to put down Orton-Gillingham. It was just too slow of a process with a child being in the public school setting and just getting 2 hours a week. I wanted to have more, a faster result, so to speak, because I knew time was going by very, very quickly. So we had our two children tested, the ones on the then seventh grader and the then third grader, and they both went through the system. The oldest one only qualified for 4 weeks. That was all he needed. And he had to give up his summer sailing program, which he adored. And I said, I know this is the pits, but you know what? We got to do something now. And so he did 4 weeks of of Linda Mood Bell. And about 2 weeks into the program, I said, you know, I know this is tough. How do you feel about this? You know, you're not out on Lake Minnetonka. Shoot. And he said, this is the best thing I ever did because now I get it. I have the tools, Mom. I'm really, really, really getting it because now I know that mountain is spelled M-O-U-N-T-A-I-N. It's not T-I-N. This is a 14-year-old boy. Three out of the four advanced classes in his of the core curriculum at Minnetonka Middle School East, and suddenly the light went off. That opaque that was is an excellent analogy. Just sort of turned transparent, and I could see it on his face. So for me, intensive training that was 20 hours a week for a 14-year-old was like a light switch for him. I can only think that if you can get a 6-year-old and a 7-year-old with that same identical situation, if it were at all possible financially or even in a smaller group, wow, we're not going to have this all these situations of year after year after year of frustration. I won't go into my fourth grade situation. Hers is very, very similar, except that her mom was on board, and I could see things at a much, much earlier and consequently
but
interview.
I kind of, if I'm threading what you're saying into some of the other messages that we've had, if all of our teachers were trained in these kinds of methods, it wouldn't be an isolated thing. It would be a part of the process of learning all along the way. And I got the representative from the Linda Boone Bell here. Why don't we invite you to the table too, so that you might get a nickel's worth in if we get a few minutes. So,
I'd rather have the parents talk. About
okay,
this.
All right, okay.
Thank
but
you very much.
Just want to acknowledge that.
And I would love to share information.
Thank you.
Time.
So, thank you very much for that.
I wanted to add I think my biggest frustration is that I had the capability to go to the expensive. Psychoeducational evaluator. We had the money to go to the Reading Center. We had the money to go to Linda Boone Bell, but I keep scratching my head thinking about all of those parents, double incomes, working hard, and I keep thinking, gosh, why can't we make it happen for them? Like, I feel that my husband and I were really able to make it happen for our own children.
Thank you.
And they are in special ed, the two. He's recently out of it because he didn't qualify anymore, but they have been in special ed as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Gretchen, who's next?
Natalie. Or you can go. Okay. My name is Rebecca Schmidt, and I'm a mother of two. I have a gifted daughter in the public schools, and I homeschool my dyslexic and dysgraphic son, who is twice exceptional, gifted and disabled. And there seems to be a recurring theme here going on that I just want to add to my comments here, is that this is not a problem of intelligence. Most dyslexics are very high IQ individuals, and I think that parents tend to feel that once they get into the system that there are people that think that their children are throwaway. And that's just not the case. They have a lot to offer. I'm currently on the Marketing and Communication Committee at the local branch of the International Dyslexia Association, a parent advisory for the Washington County's Mental Health Collaborative, and a member of our district curriculum advisory committee. Before I start, I wanted to say thank you to Senators Kathy Salzman and Jen Olson. And to all those that are involved in the process of this today, it's a great honor. Our experiences with the special education span over the last 9 years, and I have worked very hard to educate myself about the needs of disabled children to better advocate for my disabled son and others. And today I want to ask that that you hear what we have to say, and it sounds like that you have, so that's really great, and it'll help a lot of people. All children need what will work, and what will work works for all skill levels of students. This includes disabled students when given appropriate opportunities. Our past experience has shown this to be true. Our son had only made 3 months gain in a full year of school for nearly three consecutive years. We put him with an Orton-Gilliam trained tutor over the summer for a total of 18 hours of one-on-one instruction, and he was able to progress 1 year and 2 months. This year, using the Wilson reading system led by a trained instructor, our son has already progressed two reading levels so far this year. The Orton-Gilliam method and Wilson reading system are both proven scientifically researched methods for teaching reading and include a systematic and explicit instruction of the five reading strands when taught by teachers that have been trained by professionals with the practical experience needed in the areas that they are instructing in. These two methods are highly successful. Teachers need proper training because one day these same people will become administrators that will be sitting on an IEP meeting holding the purse strings to services of multitudes of children and their future. How do they make well-informed decisions without this knowledge of reading? There are many a doctorate degree tossed around these days, none of which have anything to do with teaching reading, accommodations, or assistive technology, much less the five strands of reading. All special education directors should be required to have working knowledge of these basic areas in order to effectively lead staff. As a parent, it is nothing less than a harrowing experience to walk the tightrope of advocacy with staff that know little to nothing about these areas in order to get services without offending egos. It is unfair to put parents in this position. In order to pick or design appropriate curriculum for classrooms, it is profoundly important that teachers have training that they need. Our son was in a reading program for 3 years that the manufacturer rep told us was inappropriate to meet my son's needs. This would have never happened if the reading teacher at the time would have had the proper knowledge base to make an informed decision. While participating on our district's curriculum advisory committee, it is my opinion that many new curriculum proposals are made with little to no consideration of accessibility of that curriculum by what will be a diverse student body. This seems to suggest the lack of knowledge associated with teaching reading and or the learning disabled. This could adversely affect most students, especially those that are struggling learners, identified or unidentified. All students, regardless of the skill level, benefit when the curriculum is accessible. It is important that I mention one other thing that I think you should know about, which is intimately linked with appropriate teacher education. Most people are afraid to talk about it for fear that they or their children will be judged unfairly. But simply put, when kids don't have their educational needs met in the classroom, more often than not, by no fault of their own, they are made mentally ill from the daily bombardment of stress and anxiety associated with the failure and frustration they are forced to endure year after year. Nothing can prepare a parent to see the slow and brutal disintegration of a child's self-esteem. It isn't pretty, but if one takes the time, the textbook research is there to read about this process. Our basic human instinct is to fight or flee in any situation that can cause physical or emotional pain. Even adults, when trapped in an unbearable job, just leave. But the child or children have no way out, often with no life experience to draw on for support. Lou Gehrig said, "Courage does not mean the absence of fear. Courage means being afraid and doing it anyway. But that is what we ask the learning disabled child every day to do." In closing, our experiences in the school system included a lot of things that happened, things that should not happen in a caring environment. I realized a long time ago that even good people with good intentions do bad things when they are unknowledgeable. Most teachers want to feel good about what they are doing to help children, which is why they have entered the field. It is the lack of knowledge that is holding them back, and that is why I am here. Rick Lavori, renowned author, special education lecturer, and consultant, comments, "We constantly search for ways that we can change the child. Perhaps the first significant change should come from us. In a changing world where the total sum of the world's knowledge is now doubling every 7 years, emphasizes the need to act quickly and definitively. All students have a God-given need to learn about their world, which should not be suppressed. When you deny children the right to be educated, what you are doing is creating social and economic poverty." Einstein once said that to get out of a problem, you must first change the thinking that got you into that problem to begin with.
Now, many nights I have laid in bed thinking and worrying about the future of children. I have put our story into your hands, as many others will do. Please take it from me. Now it is your turn to sleep on it, and in the morning rejoice that we have the chance to make it right.
Thank you.
Thank
That's
you.
Very powerful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Oh,
I just wanted to add, due to Cindy McCarthy, she and her parent group, she had put out an email about the National Council on Teacher Quality. And if you don't already have one, I will certainly try and get one to you, or Cindy, I'm sure, would be willing to get one to you, and it really highlights what's going on and why we're here today.
Thank you.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
We have that, and it's being distributed around the world.
Okay.
It's being distributed as just something to think about. Because, I mean, I certainly, because we do want to hear people's their thoughts and testimony, and that will be at our next hearing of, you know, what are reasons of maybe why we think there's a simple solution here. Tell us what the road bumps are. Tell us why this isn't happening. That our quest on this little topic, it's actually a very big topic, we want to be partners and we want to collaborate. We want to make good things happen instead of pointing fingers. But it does raise a number of questions, and we see it repeatedly in some of the papers that are out there. Mm-hmm. So,
and
thank you so much.
And we have the statutes, as Anne-Marie has read, and I think our message is we really mean it.
Yeah.
We do really mean it. And
that's
the
good
challenge,
to hear.
The challenge is that
we really
mean it, and we're getting allies. But we need to bring that about.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Mm-hmm. I'm Claire Eckley. I'm here for Maggie Lesher, who was not able to be here today. Maggie is was a public school educator. She had was also a peer monitor for the State Department of Education. And when I first met Maggie, she believed that the schools had all the answers. And all of a sudden, when her son was in 10th grade, she said to me, "My son is having problems in school. And the schools have the answers." And I just looked at her, and 2 weeks later, she came back and said to me, "They do not have the answers." A couple of years later, her middle school son started having problems, and all of these problems the students, her children, were having could have been identified in the primary grades and early. They certainly have had difficulty at that point with reading, and most of the time they were being told, "You're not working hard enough." And each one of them had a great desire to do well. And so I'm just sharing what she says, that it's very important to be identifying these students and not allowing them to wait until junior high or 10th grade as a sophomore, where then you have so many other items to deal with. It's not just the difficulty with reading, but it's the frustration and the, as other people have said, that could lead to drugs or could lead to juvenile delinquency or could lead to other problems. And we need to look at how we can alleviate that.
Thank you, Claire.
Mm-hmm. Can I go ahead?
Yes.
My name is Natalie Hansen, and I have a son, Connor. But first I wanted to start with, I was just telling up and listening to all this, I am also a child that had dyslexia. And I look back, and it was 36 years ago when I was in first grade and second grade. And it amazes me, and it has amazed me over this time, that we had more to offer then than we do now. That I was able to get the help that I needed than I do now. And so I wanted to tell you about Connor. As a small child, he was very happy and advanced like all of the children have been. When Connor got to school, I noticed very early in first grade that he was having difficulty with reading. I, as they said, He's a boy, and he'll get it, and he might be at the end of the spectrum of when development happens. By second grade, I was still seeing the struggles, and I approached them to ask them to test him. They tested him, and he met the underachievement part, meaning his IQ was very high and his ability was very low, but he did not meet the rest of the criteria. Therefore, they could not offer him special ed. They looked at me and said, "There's nothing we can do except the interventions we are offering him, which is Read Natural and Great Leaps. And at our school, those are based on speed reading, not learning to read." And this is in second grade. They also looked at me and said, I said, "Well, what do I do?" And they said, "Well, the best thing he has going for him is a mother that cares." And I was stunned. I had no answers of why he can't read, how he will learn to read, what I should do to help him to read, other than I knew it was very, very important on his self-esteem. Connor became more and more frustrated, like you've heard from the other children. His self-esteem went downhill, and this one, once bright-eyed, giggling, happy little boy was crying every day, would rather go to bed at 5:30 than struggle getting through his reading. He has since told me that he feels he is stupid and dumb. He has been since diagnosed with a reading or an anxiety disorder relating to school, because when he is not in school during the summer, the symptoms go away. So his pediatrician has said that he needs to get help at school. It is not something we can medicate. It is related to his anxiety with school and reading. Left with no answers or hope. Wondering what I should do, because even though I got help, I didn't understand what my issues really were. I just knew I was different. I just knew that I had to work really, really hard. I just knew that I had something special to offer, but I didn't know what the answers were. I found Linda Mood Bell, and they gave me answers. Within the first visit following their testing, it was clear what Connor needed. He was able to read, and their direction was maybe he needs phonics, maybe he needs language awareness, but what I saw was way beyond that. I saw there was something that was coming in and coming out that the school couldn't teach, and it was obvious through our testing. It was the visual processing. He was not able to decode. He was not able to move things from the short-term memory to the long-term memory. So what we knew is that it was clear what he needed, and that this would not only be a huge cost, it isn't something we could afford. We knew it would be a huge time commitment, because I have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old as well. We live in Elk River, and we needed to drive to Bloomington every single day. But as parents these days, we don't think twice about putting braces on our kids. But what we came to realize is that braces don't matter if the child isn't smiling. It doesn't matter if their teeth are straight if they can't look you straight in the eyes. So we forward on to Linda Mood Bell. We made the commitment, and within the first week at Linda Mood Bell, we saw the miracle start to happen. Connor started reading billboards and road signs and arguing with me on the way home that I was going the wrong way. It's such a simple thing, but it's so powerful to him to be able to read outside the car and partake in our drive home. Then, in weeks to come, he was staying up late reading to his brothers and sisters. He pulled out a children's dictionary that I had bought for him when he was 4 years old. And he's now 9 and reading this child's dictionary. And he didn't want to go to bed. "Can't we just read 5 more minutes? Can't we read 5 more minutes?" You know, he'd ask his brother, "What do you want to learn about?" And my husband and I stood at the doorway and just looked at each other and couldn't believe that we were seeing what we were seeing. Not long, he was spelling supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. It was a joke at the very first day that Linda said, "At some time, you will spell supercalifragilisticexpialidocious." My husband and I looked at each other and said, didn't believe it. One day, Linda greeted me at the door. She said, "You will not believe what he did on his own, on his five-minute break." And she showed me the paper, and he had spelled supercalifragilisticexpialidocious alone, no incentive, no reward, except he knew he could do it. He had the confidence to do it. Connor felt success at Linda Moodbell. He asked me daily if he can go back. It wasn't easy. There was a time I came to the door to pick him up. Linda greeted me at the door and said, "We have a problem. Can you meet me in my office?" I went. She said, "Connor said he'd like to stab himself with a pencil, and he really meant it." And I looked at her and I said, "That's why we're here." And she said, "Okay." And that's all we said about it. It was a one-hour drive that he had to leave school, a four-hour commitment from a nine-year-old with 3 5-minute breaks, an hour to two-and-a-half-hour drive home because this was in the winter with snow, and he would rather go there than go to school. He would rather give up his friends and recess and go there because he felt success. And we still use these strategies with him at home. What I'd like to say is that not being able to read for these kids is awful. I know how it feels. I have sat over there with tears because I know how it feels. Sorry, because I was one of these kids. And I'm 43 years old and I still have tears. I still want to hide it. I still want it to go away. It won't go away with the birthday. It won't go away with another teacher. It won't go away to a different school. It is what we have, and we have to deal with it. So with my gratitude for Linda Moodbell when we were done, I wanted to write a thank you. And as I was writing the thank you in a little card, it became a poem. I could not write a thank you. So what I did is I wrote The Journey. I'm not going to read it. I'm going to ask you to take one if you would like and read it at your own leisure. But it explains that it is more than just fixing the reading. It's fixing the heart in the children as well. So thank you.
Thank you. We got a couple more here.
Yes. My name is Kate Toma, and I have a 9-year-old son. His name is Calvin. Your statement was so emotional, I'm still kind of upset myself. It just hits home. But we have just recently found out that Calvin has dyslexia. And about 2 months ago, I called a tutor in an utter state of panic. And even today, it doesn't take much for me to feel that same panic and that same frustration. I think that what she had to offer about going to my school and feeling as if I have to finesse them into understanding that what they're doing doesn't work, it's awful. Because as a parent, you just want so badly just to offer what you know is going to work. And with all the scientific basis that says that this works, I'm incredibly frustrated and in a panic that it's not in place. These women back here said that they've been struggling with their issues and they've developed Moms on a Mission over 30 years ago. It puts me in a state of panic. I think that my story is so much about luck, in that I'm lucky to be fortunate enough to be able to pay for what my son needs. I'm lucky that I have friends that are willing to tell me painful stories about what they have gone through, so that I can learn from that. And I'm lucky to have stumbled upon an amazing tutor that has been able to educate me in all these fancy words that we're using today that I still am struggling to understand. I'm a CPA, and I'm a tax accountant. And that's a very systematic approach in how we teach someone to become a tax accountant. And I don't understand how something as basic as reading cannot be considered a systematic approach, that our teachers somehow are teaching it differently in schools just across the street from each other. It doesn't make sense. I don't want it to have to be about luck and about money. And so I guess what I really learned today is that I hope something's done sooner than later. That's all I have to say.
Thank you much.
Thank you so much.
My name is Mike Christensen. Thank you very much for letting me speak to your subcommittee this morning. My daughter is in the fourth grade in the St. Paul Public Schools. And she is, when she was little, she loved to listen to stories, but she was not interested in reading at all. And the end of kindergarten, she could recognize maybe half of the alphabet, and her teacher said that she'll catch up. You know, don't worry, she'll catch up. In first grade, was a big frustration for her and for us. Her homework would take, in first grade, her homework would take about an hour a night, and it usually ended in tears. We asked the teacher what could we do, what was going on, you know, what could we do to help her. And the blunt answer that we received from the teacher is, she just doesn't try, which I didn't understand, and it made me mad and my wife mad, that how can a first grader not know how to try? You know, she loves to learn. She wants to be in school. We asked, what can we do? And the suggestion we have is, well, read to her. So we read some more to her. Second grade, we still had the same struggles. Homework was taking an hour to an hour and a half each night, ending in tears, frustration for her and for us. We asked the school for help. We did not receive any. So we went out on our own and had her tested, and she was diagnosed with dyslexia. And we started working with a tutor right away. And when third grade started, the beginning of the year, we requested that she be formally tested. And we were told that she would need to go through two 12-week intervention programs and before she could be tested. And the program that the school put in place was she would meet with a literacy teacher twice a week. The literacy teacher was not trained to work with dyslexic kids. The other two things they put in place was peer reading and volunteer adult reading. And we asked the school how another third grader and an adult coming into the school is going to help her learn how to read. And the answer that we got was, it's practice. She needs the practice. From the time we requested formal testing, the school administrators, teachers, and the literacy teacher continually told us that she's not the worst kid in her class. So what they were basically telling us is, why are you bothering us? There's other kids that are worse off than she is. Through this time, we were still working with the teacher or with the tutor, and she was making very, very big gains in progress with the tutor. And in the end of November, we had an update meeting with the school, the administrators, the teachers, and the literacy teacher. And she had made some progress, and they were very proud of all the work that they had done to help her. And we changed schools. And the old school was very happy to see us go. They told us that she was going to be much better off now. They couldn't wash their hands of her enough and of us quickly enough. The new school is a much better environment, but it still lacks the teachers that have formal training to work with kids that have dyslexia or other reading difficulties and issues. The end of March, again, we made the request in September for the formal testing to see if she would qualify for special education. In March, the 24 weeks of intervention programs came up, and they tested her. In April, middle to end of April, the test results came back, and we're sitting in a conference room with the school administrators, the teacher, the special education teachers, and they were all very sympathetic. They all acknowledged that she was behind, that she was failing. She was 1.8 years behind her peers, but she wasn't failing enough to qualify for the special education. She wasn't the two-year threshold behind her peers. So we've continued with the private tutoring, and in our, from everything that we've worked with the school, the school that we're at right now does try. They try very hard. They have some good things in place. But again, it's not, the people that are doing the work are not trained. And the biggest advances or gains that we've had, that our daughter has made, has been outside of the public school system.
Thank you for sharing that. One more?
Is this the point, Madam Chair?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
One thing I think that we were talking about this, or I was talking about with somebody else, was that when you think about many classrooms where a child is struggling to read, we've heard that, we've heard from some people that these reading strategies are very complex and difficult to maybe incorporate into an undergraduate curriculum. I mean, we've heard that from some people, not all. And yet when we see many times our struggling readers in our schools, I've seen this when my children were little, the child who's having problems reading is sent out in the hallway with a volunteer, mm-hmm. or sent out with someone who is coming in. And I just raise that as an issue. And many times in many schools, so I think, you know, it's just an issue of who's spending the extra time. Where are the children getting the extra instruction? And if there's an argument about that, we need to look at how we're actually doing our extra reading time. Although there are volunteers who are extremely well trained in these strategies, who are also very, very effective. So I think we have two sides to look at there.
Okay, one more?
Madam Chair and Co-Chair, my name is Michelle Traxler, for the record. I was asked, I ran into Claire Eckley at the Department of Education hearing on December 3rd, and I told her about my son Maxwell, who is, in my estimation, a success story. At 6 months of age, he had meningitis, and I was told at that point that he would have learning disabilities and he would have problems.
Could you line up more with a mic? Thank you.
He had meningitis at 6 months. I was told then that he would probably have problems. He would have learning disabilities and vision problems and a number of things, and to be careful and diligent in his education and throughout his many hospitalizations and 8 brain surgeries and a number of just horrific events in his life, I've stayed with him and watched him go through his school. I picked a school in South Minneapolis, a private Catholic school, who emphasizes a humongous reading program. They use phonics, they use vocabulary, comprehension, and all of the things that I've heard everybody talk about today. And they have done an unbelievable job with a child who was going to be a huge problem. And from the very beginning at the school, he has done a remarkable job. He has missed more school than you can imagine. He's had so many surgeries. He's been in the hospital. These kids at his school come to the hospital. They come to our home. They take turns. His teachers have come. Everyone has come to be with him and to help him and to read to him and to work him through his things. And he's done an incredible job. And then 2 years ago, he was in a motor vehicle accident through no fault of his own, was hit by the light rail train, and had a traumatic brain injury. He has, over the last 2 years, overcome anxiety, pain, 3 more brain surgeries, and he is the top of his class. He scored 99 percentile on the Metropolitan 8 in the Twin Cities, and I credit Visitation Catholic School in South Minneapolis for the diligent, hardworking teachers. He's a real success for He could have been pulled out. He could have been in special education, but they stuck with him. They worked through all of these things and all these techniques that I've heard all these women talk about today, and they really stuck by him. And he is a real success story.
Well,
and I'd just like to share that with you today. I did bring an essay that he wrote last year after the crash that he read in front of the congregation, 300 people. He wrote it by himself. And he used all the techniques he learned in school, and he stood up there in front of all those people and read this essay to them.
And you'll share, leave that with us?
And I will leave that with you.
Thank you.
It's very
really,
much. It's really wonderful.
You know, I've been sitting here reflecting, and, you know, in this state, and we're not alone, but I think Minnesota historically has placed high value on education. We've done lots of things. We've believed that parents should have choices and choice of education, but fundamental to it all, we believe that we should have a strong public education system. And I would not want anybody to interpret our efforts here, and I think even the thoughts that you are expressing, as attempting to bash our public school system. That's not it. But we know in the times that we're challenged with resources that we have to do the very best that we can with the resources that we have and make strategic investments where they're needed. And I think you've been driving home a very important point that perhaps due to the fact that we all approach life from the experiences that we have, and many of us, and I've been a public school teacher, that's where my career started. And I have not, it's only, I have been touched by someone close to me with that, and I didn't understand it at the time, with some of the same experiences that you have been describing today. But you don't understand it unless you've really experienced it. And I think it is so exciting that all of you, and so many of you, have taken that extra measure of time to research and pull together and understand that there are things that we can be doing that are better for all of our students, that will make our public schools stronger, that will make our teachers more satisfied with success that they can experience if we have them prepared to do some of the things that your children have required and so many more that you are hopefully speaking for that aren't here or don't know what we're up to, that is our mission. And so I think Senator Saltzman and I are glad to join the Moms with a Mission. I'm not even a mom. but I still have a passion for the value and the importance of reading and how every parent wants their child to be successful in this area. And without it, you can't do it. So thank you very much.
Just add something, Senator Olson. I think what today was most powerful for me is that I sit on the achievement gap on our work group there, and we've had parent testimony, but you are speaking for those parents as well today. And I commend you for that, because I have heard repeatedly from all of you, I had the means. I was able to do this for my child. But every child deserves this. And we're not, though, talking about every child deserves in fourth or fifth or sixth or seventh grade to have a private tutor. Every child in this state, we should be able to identify those children who are within, you know, not, it's sort of like nip the problem in the bud.
Yes.
Let's start to find kids before they fall too far behind and address these issues. And it's not, you know, it's really smart. We should be able to sell this because it's cost effective.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
But to us, it's also about the kids. And hearing these stories today of the pain that families and children go through because they're struggling, and I think about all those kids who aren't here in some of our other committees, and we're seeing this. You spoke for them today too. So you can go home tonight and put your head on your pillow and say you did good work. But you know, you have to hang in there with us, because you haven't quite pass the baton to us. We need to carry the baton together for a while.
Yes.
And to make our case. And our game plan here is to have one more hearing and talk about staff development in a what we believe will be a very good and spirited discussion. And then we'll have one more hearing because we'd like to come up with, you know, some recommendations that will then be taken to our full education policy committee. And that's sort of our plan, that we'll have something in place that will then be presented to the entire education policy committee. And I don't know if the E-12 will become involved in terms of finance, but we certainly appreciate your courage to share your stories today, because we felt, I guess, honored to be able to hear them today.
Thank you. Thanks for sticking with us this whole time. The meeting is adjourned.
Good job, guys.